Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Now, just a quick note before we begin, I want to say very quickly that it is unbelievably hot in my office right now, and I can't cool it down for various reasons. So if you are watching on YouTube, I apologize for the fact that I'm about to look like I'm in a sauna. That being said, let's get into the news of today. Bunch of stuff has been happening recently, but let's start with this one. I don't know how to describe him. One of the sort of foremost intellectuals of the Thabo Mbeki administration, Joel Netshedintshe, has written a sort of response to the BEE debate in the Daily Maverick. And boy, is it quite a defense. Now, it has lots of graphs and things, and there's a lot to say about it. I'll just read a little bit from the intro and the conclusion. But please, if you're interested in it, do go check it out on the Daily Maverick. The attempt to discredit Black economic empowerment is about material self-interest and a sense of entitlement to historical privilege. Undergirded by international white supremacist alliances, the battle to designate post-colonial South Africa as the DEI incarnate should be expected to intensify. Is how Netshedintshe begins this. And he goes on to sort of describe how, you know, whites still hold certain top management positions in society, how, you know, all of the things that were done to undermine, for example, Black entrepreneurship over the years during apartheid and the pre-apartheid period, the sort of composition of the various sections of the workforce and how many people are, you know, like how many skilled professionals are Black or this or that. And he also claims that basically all the positive economic progress that's come for Black South Africans in South Africa is to some degree as a result of BEE policies. At one point he says, a careful analysis of triple BEE ownership points to the following fact, which debunk the fairy tale that only 100 people gained a trillion rand from the policy. The beneficiary pool in terms of Black shareholding stands at around 3.4 million people. Between 2002 and 2019, the number of Black-owned firms has doubled. In the past 5 years, the indication is that large and small firms are increasingly implementing employee share ownership programs and community ownership. Empowerment has resulted in the growth of the Black middle strata through saving management positions and skills training from about 1.7 million in 2004 to 4.2 million in 2012 and much higher now, with the public sector playing a leading role. He then also ends the piece by saying this. In conclusion, let us return to the question, whence does the inversion of logic in the attempt to discredit Black economic empowerment find its genesis? In part, it is the psychosis of white victimhood, that white people are exceptional and face exceptional threats, but at its core, it is about the material self-interest and a sense of entitlement to historical privilege, undergirded by international white supremacist alliances. For those who question the contrived cost of Black economic empowerment, it may be useful to weigh the cost of not having it. Besides betraying the constitutional imperative, failure to implement corrective action and do so in an appropriate manner would delegitimize the democratic polity and the entire social system. And so those who prefer to shake the hornet's nest and mock the marginalized for their patience must beware, because even with the backing of the most powerful forces in the world, they will not be able to prevent Iqbal's words from coming to pass. And then he quotes from this poem, rise and arouse the poverty stricken and shake the foundations of the palaces of the rich. Warm up the blood of the slaves with the fire of faith and make the sparrow dare to fight the eagle. The time of sovereignty of the masses has arrived. In such an unmanaged and unmanageable clash of base instincts, no one but no one shall be the winner. Okay. Bit messy of a summary there that I gave it, but do check it out if you want to see it for yourself. But Michael, there's so many things I think to say about this. Maybe we should start with the conclusion. And it struck me that there is something in this that feels a little bit like the tactics of the Swart Gevaar that the apartheid government used. They sort of said, well, you need to support us or else, you know, the Black population is going to rise up and destroy white South Africa and murder everyone, and it'll be like total communist hellscape forever and ever, and everyone will be dead or in prison. This feels an awful lot like that argument. You must, you know, the sort of the claim here is that the poor are just chomping at the bit, that they're just demanding these sort of state-driven initiatives, that they're demanding the redistribution of land, that they're demanding the total implementation of BEE. And if this doesn't happen, then people are going to rise up in a sort of uncontrolled mob and, you know, destroy everyone. I mean, that was an argument Julius Malema made in his infamous "I'm not calling for the genocide of white people yet" speech, right? Ooh. He was saying if there is not a guided revolution, there will be an unguided revolution. Seems a little bit like Nietzsche Tenze is doing a similar thing here, and it amounts to a kind of sleight of hand, firstly, to claim that BEE is as popular as it is, when it polling not just from us, but from organizations like News 24, have shown that it's, you know, not actually that popular. It's, you know, many, many South Africans, including Black South Africans, basically don't agree with it. And secondly, it sort of hides the intent here. It's like, this is the only path to empowerment, and everything else is just, you know, you trying to maintain your privilege. Your thoughts on all of this?
I think the first thing, just to pick up on your quoting from Joel Nechtenzi's last lines, is that poetry, unfortunately, does not improve his argument. And to consider the meaning of that, one needs only to go up to the very first section of the, I think, fourth or fifth paragraph of his piece, where he talks about the injunctions of our Constitution, which are intended to, quote, heal the divisions of the past and establish a society based on democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights. And second, improve the quality of life of all citizens and free the potential of each person. Now, if you take that and you contrast that with our current condition, which after 30 years, there's this basic unasked question, which he does not approach, is why are Black people worse off 30 years after apartheid? Why are they still in the same position, essentially, than they as they were in 1994? One of the most important truths about South Africa, which our colleague Gabriel Krause often brings out, is that the richest South Africans are Black and the poorest South Africans are Black. And what we see is a policy regime of 30 years, or slightly less than 30 years, I think BEE really came in at the end of the 90s, a policy regime which has produced a super wealthy elite, well-connected people, getting all the tenders, tenderpreneurs. There's a very good reason why this is a new word in international English, as a matter of fact, but certainly in South African English, a prominent word in South African English, tenderpreneurs. We all know exactly what that means. Tembisa, 2 billion rand. You just need to you say those two things and everybody understands exactly what we're talking about. You have this tiny, enriched, blatantly enriched elite, as our colleague Herman Pretorius is fond of saying. And then the immiserated masses who are still waiting for the better life they were promised in 1994. And the reason for that is precisely that what BEE does, ironically, Joel Nechtenzi speaks about white exceptionalism. It's BEE that suggests that white exceptionalism is the thing, that there are white people in this country who really want the economy to be anemic, growth to be slow, unemployment to be huge, their lives to be more expensive. For what reason? It's not explained. But for some reason, he seems to believe that the failure of transformation and change in society is to be laid at the door of people who really actually want a society that doesn't work. And it simply isn't true. The other argument that he makes implicitly here, I haven't read the entire piece, whether he addresses directly, but is this notion of empowerment, that people who are opposed to Black economic empowerment are opposed to empowerment. In fact, the people who are most vocally opposed to Black economic empowerment, BEE, like ourselves, the IRR, are expressly in favor of empowerment that works. And that is really the thing that cuts to the heart of the what I'm inclined to call the ridiculousness of his proposition is that people he's shouting down are people who are arguing for real empowerment and real change, real transformation in the society, the massive expansion of the middle class, the massive expansion of the tax base to be able to sustain the whatever support is still needs to be given to poor people who don't have the wherewithal and are not going to likely have jobs and for the next 10 years and so on, without there being an increased tax base, more economic growth, that is simply not going to happen. So people who are making that argument are in fact making an argument for greater transformation, more effective empowerment, and exactly the kind of change that, ironically, he suggests the Constitution endorses BEE for. So it really is. I think it's kind of cruel irony in a way, but perhaps it also reflects, as you say, the popular opinion is shifting steadily away from BEE because people are not fools. South Africans are not fools. They're also not revolutionary. And there's no ticking time bomb. Whenever I read that silly cliche and similar things like, you know, the serfs rising up, South Africans are not serfs. Isn't it ridiculous? It's completely ridiculous. South Africans have all got the vote. We're living in a free society, and they're going to choose differently, and that's what's happening. And there's a complete panic setting in among those who are supporting policies that have failed, and this is the result, unfortunately. I'm sure Joel Chitenzi is a perfectly fine chap, but I'm afraid he's on the losing wicket here.
There's this part of this as well, which is a kind of idea that there's a sort of zero-sum economics thought in here, right? It's that, white South Africans are so desperate they can only be wealthy or only have a good life at the sort of expense of black South Africans. They can only enjoy the privilege that they can, which is just not true. As has been pointed out by many analyses, when you look at one of the apartheid, that it damaged the economic prospects basically of everyone. It made a couple of people very rich, right? There were some people who could genuinely benefit. There were some sections of the population who would say, okay, well, they wouldn't be able to get that high paying a job without racial preference, so they sort of benefited. But this is relatively small interest groups, even compared to the majority of the white population, who, because of the suppression of skills, of entrepreneurial opportunities, of all the things that basically the human capital of black South Africans, the economy as a whole, was severely damaged, was severely limited. And what we saw in the 90s when apartheid was fully pulled apart was the freeing up of that human capital. Even people who had relatively nothing were able to begin making much more of a life for themselves, as things like Job Reservation and Group Areas Act and all these horrible apartheid laws fell away. People began to sort of uplift themselves where they could, and where they couldn't, they still saw material improvements in their lives. And there's this sort of idea here that if we hadn't had BEE, I mean, one of the statistics here he gives is a number of people in skills training. I mean, you know, never mind that I think skills training often ends up being like, often companies do it without, you know, actually like really doing proper skills training. It's just like a sort of bureaucratic box ticking exercise where you went on the course and they say you're trained. but put that aside. He says, you know, the number of people getting skills training went from 1.7 million to 4.2 million. As if South Africa had any other choice. If this country was to grow or change or improve in any way whatsoever for all its citizens, it needed to massively increase the amount of skills in the population, the level of education in the population, the level of wealth. There's more people with money. There's more people to buy stuff. There's more people with education. There's more people to hire to make your business or your work easier and more efficient. The whole economy could not grow because of the horrific crushing of the human spirit that apartheid did. And simply by ending it, we freed up so much human capacity. And it's not because of BEE that those limited successes happened. It's despite BEE. those limited successes happened because you can't keep people down who have a desire to rise up unless you try. You can't. People won't be kept down if they have the space to grow their own lives. And that, I think, is one of the lessons here. But, Michael, any thoughts on what I've just said?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say about this. I've often referred to the figures which I remember particularly Franz Grenier bringing out about the period immediately after 94, with the massive expansion of university admissions, youngsters who just hadn't had the opportunity before. Nobody was compelling them to do it. There was no law compelling, you know, matric students to work extra hard, work weekends, try and desperately, even in those days, overcome what was still a kind of present black education, Bantu education system, in a sense. I mean, it had changed, but it was still, you know, township schooling and all the rest of it. These were young people who felt that the lid had been lifted off their lives, and it was up to them. And if they worked hard, they could get into university. They get into university, they could move on. For all the problems we've seen over the years because of deficiencies in education, whatever it might be, that human impulse to succeed, to get ahead, to meet that ambition, has been visible everywhere. And if we look right across society in every possible sphere, we see exactly that. And the thing that is holding people back is an economy that is anemic in its growth, that is just sort of stumbling, limping along, and people just desperate for opportunities. And the opportunities would come with a growing economy, with, you know, dynamism in the private sector. That is really what is transformative. And this constant meddling via legislation and so on, and dictates and so on, is actually counterproductive. Is serving, yeah, no end.
You know, one of the points he makes is this kind of, there's also a lot of socialist claptrap in this. He's sort of saying that, well, you know, we couldn't without something like BEE to level the scales, because, you know, monopolies. There's even a more. He's talking about. Something like BEE is more critical in a system such as ours, in which monopolies hoard virtually all markets, making it difficult for local cooperatives and other small enterprises even to provide school feeding. As such, opening up an entity within established enterprises through share ownership has to be an important part of economic empowerment. The reality is, I mean, one of the facts he gives here is what, between 2022 and 2019, the number of black-owned firms has doubled. I think that's actually quite a low number. And the reason that that's a low number is because opening a new business in South Africa is so difficult regardless of what race you are. There aren't, you know, different rules for white business owners and for black business owners. What happens is that government tries to micromanage the whole economy, that it stifles economic development, and it actually protects these so-called monopolies that he says are choking all of our market. The reason that big business continues to be so, I think, important in South Africa, and why we don't have nearly as much entrepreneurship as we could, is because we're overtaxed and overregulated, which prevents this emergence. So on one hand, it's like, well, we need this policy because the economy is sort of stacked against the people who it's helping. Well, the reason the economy is stacked against the people who it's helping is because the cost of entry to the economy is so high. If you lowered the cost of entry to the economy, you wouldn't need the program. Not that the program works anyway, as we've pointed out at length in many discussions. But powerful, Michael.
Exactly. And, you know, and one of the sort of crushing ironies here is that it's the big companies who can sustain or absorb the costs that for a small company is just punitive, you know, fatally punitive often. So big companies can sustain the costs of all these regulatory burdens and racial injunctions and so on, and proceed. And maybe sometimes one does see this, perversely enough, it's a terribly cynical thing, but one does see this, where they will pally up to the policymakers and say, well, you know, let's just continue doing this. The ultimate effect on them is that it reduces their competition from young upstarts, because the young upstarts just cannot get ahead. with this ridiculous burden that has, you know, nil impact on nil sort of benefit to them or to society. So it's a horrific circumstance, actually, and quite perverse that he should be defending it in this way.
Right. And the other problem, of course, is all of this is just the simple fact that, you know, when we've seen, like, even if you take B out of the theoretical, we've seen how it works in practice. And that has been, you know, revealed through things like the Zondo Commission, where these are not bugs of the process. These are features of the process that small groups of politically connected people have captured institutions. And they've used BE and transformation as covers to basically just loot coffers and things, and, you know, basically ruin the potential of government to actually provide things and assist the poorest people in the country. Just a much more articulate and well thought out defense in a lot of ways, I think, than so much of the defense of BE. At least here he tries to make claims that BE has actually created some sort of genuine economic positives for the country. But still, I think it has all the same fundamental problems as so many of the defense of BE.
And that just makes me think of it, you know, something that I think I mentioned in a staff discussion recently, that to my mind, you know, I'm pretty sure that a fair amount of the existing black middle class probably thinks to itself that BEE has in fact been the source of its success. And the argument that needs to be made is that it's the same impediment as it is to anyone else applied to them, and that a completely freed and dynamic economy is in fact going to serve them so much better. I think that's the argument that really needs now to be made. I think there was a time in the 90s, I remember seeing, we were chatting before the show, seeing people who were affirmative action appointees who got positions maybe before they were really experienced enough to take them on, but took them on, at least half, I would say, succeeded. And at that time, I think it was quite a legitimate thing to do. But 30 years on, we're a mature society, we're a mature economy, just being held back by the retention of these bad policies.
Indeed. Anyway, apologies for some of my all over the placeness. The heat, I think, is getting to me a bit. Let's move on to our next topic, G20. It was declared by some commentators as a great victory for South Africa, a win, despite US opposition to a leader's declaration from the G20 at the sort of the conclusion of the conference. A conclusion was drawn up. I think Argentina was the only country attending that didn't support this final declaration. Now, these things are usually kind of done almost entirely by consensus. They're always like sort of kind of a bit vague and mushy, and we'll develop this and everyone will get puppies and kittens kind of stuff. But the usual rule up till now has been that everyone basically agrees on the consensus statement at the end, and then that's the end of that. So this is the first time, I guess, it's been fought over. And this was hailed by some as a diplomatic win. I saw Adrian Basson suggesting that it was a huge win for South Africa. Peter Bruce wrote his opinion piece. I'm just trying to find the exact headline. U.S. President Donald Trump has done more to energize the electoral prospects of the ANC in the past 2 weeks than I can possibly calculate. And this is where Mavuso from Business Leadership South Africa wrote a piece called SA Should Be Proud of the G20, but its rule of law needs work. I think that's putting it a little bit mildly. She, while talking about this, says that South Africa should be proud of its hosting of the G20 mission meetings. Last week's event, including the B20 summit and the G20 Leaders Forum, showed the world that what we are capable of, with smooth logistics, good infrastructure, and most importantly, a deft handling of the complex political and diplomatic processes that had to be followed. Many things to say here. From the South African's perspective, I think that, you know, you could, I mean, when I was talking about this on Friday, I was very sort of why are we deciding not to hand over the leadership to someone who we think is too junior, right? This is what Ramaphosa's office has said, that because the US isn't sending some senior government official, we're not going to be handing things over to them. And this caused the White House to say that South Africa was refusing to facilitate a smooth transition of its presidency to the G20 major economies to the US after the G20 issued a declaration on climate change over US objections. Okay, we managed to capitalize on the sort of anti-American sentiment that's out there in the world right now. And, you know, get the Europeans and India and such to sign on to this declaration. But I don't really understand what this gets us, much less how this rebounds to Ramaphosa's electoral benefit. I don't know, Michael, it just seems sort of very overwrought, the meaning of the significance of all of this. What's your take on all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing a slightly embarrassing game playing in public, which is, it's a little bit unseemly in a way. It's perfectly fine for organizers of a big event to be proud that the microphones worked and the lights didn't go out and, you know, things sort of kind of went smoothly. But it's not about us, you know, it's not about South Africa, is it? You know, it's, which I think ironically was also Trump's mistaken position, is that he kind of made it about South Africa, but it's not really, in my view, it's not about South Africa. I think it could have been much more vigorous and challenging if J.D. Vance had actually come to South Africa and stood up and said, you guys don't know what you're doing, you don't know what you're talking about, this is why, or whatever he might have wanted to say. Or the opposite, maybe let's make this work. You know, we're going to accept you into the pantheon of U.S. friends in the world, and we're going to work together. But here's how it's going to happen. Here's how we want it to happen. We want you to do certain things, and we'll do certain things, and let's talk. And well, whatever the case might be, but you know, for this kind of slightly tit for tat, slightly childish game playing, we're not going to hand over to you, and you know, we're not going to send anyone to your country, and it's all a bit. And of course, nobody's going to read this wretched declaration. Nobody's remotely interested in what it says. It's about a bit like all these other sort of major declarations that emerge from meetings now and then. That's not really, I don't think, what it's about. I think there certainly is a very great advantage, as far as I can see, or certainly in my way of thinking about it, in leaders of important countries actually sitting across whatever the space is, seeing each other physically and talking to one another about things, just being that much more familiar. I think there's a huge advantage in that, and it strikes me as a pity that the United States wasn't here. The same could be true even of China. You know, I always think I know from personal experience. You know, you write about somebody, maybe in scathing terms or in terms, unflattering terms of some kind, and then you meet them. And first of all, you've got to get over the fact that you've said all these things in public about them. And then you actually, you know, you can have an argument, maybe. You can recognize that you really do differ and that maybe there was some basis for saying what you said. But the relationship is immediately different, and you've got to engage with that new reality. So I think, to me, that's the virtue of something like the G20. But yeah, I mean, and as far as ANC's electoral prospects, no, I don't think South Africans are even remotely interested in how well or how badly South Africa did in the G20. They're simply looking at whether there's water, whether the electricity works, the Tembisa 2 billion, the Zondo Commission recommendations. Those are the things that really, and BEE, you know, just keep, and blaming apartheid. You know, as long as all that's still going on, they couldn't get two hoots how well the G20 went or not. Yeah.
Yeah, I suspect that this was all sort of like, well, we have to have a headline out of the G20, I suppose. So we're going to supremacists, but I doubt will anyone remember this in 2 weeks. Maybe that's saying more about me than other people, but I suspect I won't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, all credit to them for for pressing out. It was difficult, and you know all the rest of it. But it, you know, no, it's not a major thing, unfortunately.
Last topic. I mean, we've gone long here, partly I think due to me not being able to focus on the time, but nonetheless, it's probably worth saying something about it. Social media, or specifically X, formerly known as Twitter, has been abuzz with a new feature that was added to X, which has gotten people riled up in all sorts of interesting ways. This feature showed where the account is based, basically where it was when you were when it was created, or where you've, I think, logged into it sort of most recently or for an extended period of time, and which sort of app front you downloaded X from. And this has been rather amusing because it's exposed that an awful number of people, particularly quite political accounts who often posted very exciting, inflammatory thing, often pretending to be American, but not exclusively, were in fact not even close to the people that they pretended that they were. For example, an account called Jessica, at Jess89911, is a sort of like account of a woman who purports to be a Scottish nationalist, and it's full of like rah rah Scotland must be independent now political content. She posted relatively recently, when Scotland leaves the UK, we also want to take what's ours with us. No more London rule ever. However, that account appears to be based in Iran. numerous other ones, an account with, I think, a few hundred thousand subscribers. I didn't actually double check just before we started, but it's called Ultra MAGA Trump 2028. It's based in Nigeria. Now, look, there's all sorts of accounts of this, and everyone has been having fun exposing someone on their ideological opposite side being in the wrong country, right, from where they purport to be. And it's not a very super accurate tool. Basically, it can be fooled by a virtual private network. If you're sort of connecting into the account through the virtual private network, then you can fool it to think you're in a country you're not. Or in other cases, maybe you're temporarily in a particular place, like some of these accounts have tried to defend themselves by saying, no, I am American. I'm just working in Nigeria, which is theoretically possible, but it's a little bit too common of a story, I think, to be the case in most cases. But Michael, it raises some interesting questions about sort of how we think about social media in general. Firstly, I think it is only really now beginning to be realized just how much of the internet, I think, is essentially, in my opinion, kind of fake. Bots, which are just programmed to give certain responses to certain things, advertising, marketing campaigns, people running political operations, and all of this is done to kind of shape the choices of consumers, the location of donations to particular events or causes. I mean, a lot of these accounts, what they've done is if they've either monetized engagement on their accounts, or they've used it as a way to then say, if you would like to support me, this fake person, please send money to this PayPal account, which has no accounting or auditing or anything like that. What do you make of all this?
I think it's I think a very telling development. Hats off to X for doing this. To the extent that what it confronts us with is this very great difficulty of anonymity. I often think, you know, when you hear people talking about the public square, and often X or social media will be presented as the new version of the public square. And I often think to myself, well, it's actually not the public square. It's a very anonymous place. I'm very conscious of this on The Daily Friend. We have a very open, light touch moderation policy. I borrow this phrase from my former colleague, Maurice Rurt, who was the former moderator. One's very conscious of how many of the contributions, very forceful, very frank, sometimes indelicate contributions come from people who use a non-diplume. And we have no idea who they are. We don't know if they're real. We don't know if, you know, what they're, if it's good faith participation or if it's nefarious activity. You have no clue. And it is a worry. You know, it is a worry, the risk that anonymity in fact undermines the veracity and the virtue of having a public square, literally public conversation about things that matter. So I think this, you know, this does help us think about, at least think about the risks, and bring us face to face with, you know, some of the the unintended sort of revelations that it produces. It's a difficult thing. Should people who want to contribute to a public conversation name themselves? We dispense with all this, all the apparent protections of non-diplumes and anonymity. I think it's a good debate, but a very interesting development in social media.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of practical concerns around that as well, right? Like, you know, do you have to then, you know, how do you prove that you are who you say you are? Yeah. Say, I'm John Smith. How do I prove that I'm John Smith? Well, presumably you'd have to use some sort of government-issued ID. Now, you know, maybe in you know, America, that's fine. Maybe in Canada, that's fine, whatever. But then in Iran, you know, if you're a dissident and you're trying to do that, then it becomes more complicated. In other places, maybe, you know, this is an account that you're not doing anything necessarily nefarious, but, you know, maybe you're engaging in like an embarrassing hobby or something. You know, maybe you're like a tough macho guy who cuts down trees all day. You're a, you know, lumberjack, but you're like really into, I don't know, kind of interior decorating or something that all of your friends think is bad. So you have a secret account that does that. Or maybe you're into weird sex things or something. Like, there's a lot of reasons for people to be anonymous, and it's kind of difficult to tell. You know, X is not like, it's not like the public political platform, right? There isn't X politics. It's just sort of a chaotic mess of 1,000,000,000 voices and ideas just going out into the void constantly. So it's kind of difficult even to set the sort of rules for this because, you know, maybe someone, you know, having an embarrassing hobby being anonymous is something that would be very different to someone who's trying to make some sort of politically manipulative campaign. And it all gets very complicated in the sort of practical sense then of how you actually kind of affect some of the change. Because I do agree that, you know, I used to be more fond of kind of anonymity as a as a thing on the internet, but I think the experience of the last decade has turned me against that idea. And I do think that there is a good argument for, as you say, Michael, you know, if you're going to defend an idea in the public space, then you have to sort of put forward what your name is and who you are. I don't know. Any final thoughts on this one before we close?
Yeah, I mean, I think all the things you raise are very important, especially the idea of people who whose opinions or information we would very likely need or want to hear because they're saying important things about their society, but they wouldn't be able to say if they were identified or if somebody in their society could identify them. So, I think this is a real concern. I often think back to the quite naive and simplistic days of editing a print newspaper letters page. And we had a rule that if you could use a non-diplume so as long as we knew your name and your address. And, you know, you realize how the world has moved on. A printed newspaper circulating in a given area, it was absolutely fine to say, well, you know, you live at 25 Myrtle Road, Claremont. You know, this is an address in the phone book, pretty much. We've got that information. We know your name, so we're quite happy to call you, Outraged of Claremont, whatever the case might be. But that's all changed. You know, it's the audience of any media is completely international. And how does one actually do this? We can't verify everything that we read or that we are proffered as proof of who somebody might be. It is just a very interesting problem that this generation and the next will have to and so on will have to contend with. But I think, nevertheless, not thinking about it is worse than having to contend with it. And this development by X has forced us to think just a little bit more about this problem.
Yes. No, I think you know, the place that social media has in our public debate is not, we haven't, I think, figured out sort of across the world how to actually deal with this stuff.
Yeah.
This seems like a positive first step, actually, in a lot of ways. It's Indeed. Not going to full abolition of anonymity, but it's, you know, it's a very useful piece of context going forward, and I think it'll cut out some of the grifters and manipulators. Unfortunately, though, it's very easy to get around, so its utility will not last long, but for a brief glorious moment it will be a very interesting time on social media. Okay, anyway, we've gone very long. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. Yes, apologies for my all over the placeness, but we shall be back tomorrow in a hopefully a better ventilated space for myself. Anyway, cheers everyone, and have a great day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.